You can post comments and share show ideas if you have some. You can also find us on Facebook under KBOO Bread and Roses. And if you would like to join our amazing collective of women hosts, producers, and engineers, please email Ani Haynes, KBOO's volunteer manager. Her email is volunteer@kboo.org. Tonight, I have the immense privilege to have in the studio with me two incredible champions for women's rights. Both of them have been involved in efforts to end domestic violence and have spoken out against the imprisonment of battered women. I welcome Lisa Swart and Louis Bouchard. Lisa Swart is a talented, award-winning writer, photographer, and filmmaker, known for producing world-class photos and video with a specialty in action water sports such as surfing. Well, on October 9th, 2000, Lisa Swart shot and killed her husband, Chris Northen, after 4 years of domestic abuse. She spent 12 years in Coffee Creek Correctional Facility in Wilsonville, Oregon, and was released 1 year ago. She is now speaking out against domestic violence, the limitations of Oregon laws, and the marginalization of victims of domestic abuse. We also welcome Louis Bouchard, licensed social worker, who is the founder of the nonprofit organization Voices Set Free. She founded that organization in 1997. She's a nationally recognized battered women's rights advocate and the co-author of Voices Set Free, Battered Women Speak from Prison, which was published in 1986. Louise provides workshops, presentations, and lectures around the state on the topic of violence against women and children. Over her 35-year career as a social worker, she has acquired expertise and skills in helping families navigate domestic violence and the compounding of abuse within our legal and criminal justice system. Welcome, both of you, to Bread and Roses.
Thanks so much for having us.
Yeah, thank you for being with us. And so tonight we're going to talk about the Violence Against Women Act and the ways that the state of Oregon can ensure that the protections guaranteed by VAWA are enforced at the state and local level. Mm-hmm. So let's start, Lisa, if you would give us a little bit of the history of how the Violence Against Women Act came about and what's the purpose of it and maybe some of the accomplishments of it.
Well, the Violence Against Women Act was really started by one woman named Ludie Green, and it grew in until finally then-Senator Joe Biden sponsored this legislation, and it became a national law. And what it does is it is supposed to guarantee that all persons are free from violence and fear of violence, and it was needed because state remedies have proven inadequate to protect women, and they found that crimes disproportionately affecting women are often treated less seriously than crimes affecting men, and that this gender bias permeates the court system, mm-hmm. and so they enacted these laws which are supposed to help.
Yeah, and I think this crazy amount of money, $1.6 billion, are part of the budget for the Violence Against Women Act. So, Louise, I'm curious because you've been an advocate for women victims of domestic violence mm-hmm. for years, and so I'm curious if you've seen some striking changes from before the Violence Against Women Act was. Passed in 1994 and now.
Well, I started the first program in Missouri to work with battered women in 1976, so we were ahead of the curve in terms mm-hmm. of a national piece of legislation. And the startup was a real hard road because people were not even at that level of awareness. I can remember neither was I. I didn't come out of a battered situation. I came out of the School of Social Work and heard from people on our phones that they were being abused. And I was startled, and I was upset, and mm-hmm. I didn't know who I could turn to. So at first, there was nothing about battering in any of the textbooks that I had or that I knew of. And that lack of education stalled a lot of my forward motion. of course, when they apply a law to something, it does get a lot more attention. And in 1994, I remember being happy about this, knowing that it was going to have some effect. However, by that time, I turned my attention to women who were going to prison and finding that in many ways, this law doesn't apply to a woman who takes the defense of her own life, self-defense. And we still have some contrasts here that are going on even to present day. But in general, what we had was an enormous push ahead in terms of our awareness that battering was really a crime. That is a huge step. And it's a crime that needs to have punishment that is against the person who does the assault.
Lisa, would you talk about your life before domestic violence and tell us what happened after you married Chris?
Well, I actually had one of those lives that most people dream about. I was a surf photographer. I traveled all over the world. My son had been to Fiji and Tahiti 9 times or so by the time, or maybe 14 if you count Tahiti too. By the time I went in, I just got to travel, and I worked on films. I had a contract with a literary agent to do 4 books. I worked on a movie project with a guy who wrote Sleepless in Seattle. I also did a lot of real estate developing. I mean, not developing, but I would design houses and make investments and have rentals and selling them. I did stunts for Baywatch. I was a second unit photographer on The Endless Summer 2. And I had a lot of fun, but my most important job was being a mother. I was a real attachment mom. I breastfed, and I brought my kids with me on my work projects, and that mattered to me more than any other thing that I got accomplished in my life, was just raising good children.
Mm-hmm. And you have. And so then you met Chris, and then...
Then I met Chris, and when I first met him, I thought, I scored, you know, because he was great. He was a really charming, fun, attractive man, and we had so much in common, and it was awesome. And that's why when the battering started, I didn't realize that it wasn't something I couldn't fix. Mm-hmm. I thought, well, you know, there's so much good here. Let's not just discard the whole. Let's work on it and fix it. And I think being an accomplished person, I was used to being able to fix problems. And that was kind of my modus operandi. Like, here's a problem, let's solve it. Mm-hmm. So, but what happened is that, in fact, I couldn't fix it. And then when I went to the authorities for help, they didn't help. And that made it so much worse. So, and it got to the point where, you know, my children were sleeping with a knife under their mattress because he had threatened to chop them into little pieces. And I had tried so many strategies to get help, and he had stalked us and threatened to burn down my friend's ranch when we went there. And it came down to a choice of, what can you live with? Your children getting killed, or your husband, or you getting killed? And I just made the choice that my job was to protect my children.
Mm-hmm. So. And so were you, what was your knowledge of domestic violence before it happened to you? And how about the Violence Against Women Act? Did you know anything about that?
I didn't know anything about the Violence Against Women Act. That just wasn't my world. And, you know, I was paralyzed by it because I didn't know. And I had at one point gone to a counselor and asked for help, and she evaluated my children and said that they had extreme PTSD. This was almost 2 years before, you know, the end result. And, you know, I looked into fleeing the country and was told that I could get arrested for kidnapping. And, you know, are you smarter than the whole FBI? Mm-hmm. Well, no.
Was one of the things that you were told.
Yeah. You know, because if you leave the country with your children, then you'll get arrested, you'll get put in prison, and then your batterer will have your children with nobody to protect them.
Mm-hmm.
So that was another strategy. I looked into witness protection program. Mm-hmm. I was told there was no witness protection program for a domestic violence survivor, even though I had told the police, my husband said he'll kill me if I testify against him.
Mm-hmm.
And that's in the police reports. So there was just no protection.
So as an educated woman, you decided when faced with such a terrible situation that there had to be something in place to help you. And you are very disappointed.
I was not only disappointed, I was stunned because it seemed so common sense. And the prevailing myths that, oh, there are shelters now, or, oh, you know, now there's equality for women, were, again, just these horrendous myths, because it didn't happen at all. So,
Louise, you talked about how you have been working with women who, like Lisa, decided to defend themselves. Mm-hmm. Can you tell us a little bit about that work and how many women you've been working with? And you know, it's hard to know exactly how many are out there in prison for doing that.
We are not keeping the kind of data that would shock this nation into its senses. And that is a profound loss, because we've lost many, many, many women to being killed. Many more are being killed than are actually at the defending their lives stage and actually in a prison. And the very fact that we don't keep data is a real indication of our lack of concern, our lack of vigilance, because as you look at the homicides of people in the war, other types of homicide, you see that people are noticing. But when it comes to a woman being killed in her own home, being killed as a result of violence, either from the partner, ex-partner oftentimes, it's pretty small print in most of the news areas where you'd look for things. And the stories are so minor, not even giving a descriptor of what led up to that homicide, so that women aren't learning anything necessarily where we would expect them to be able to gain an information that they need so desperately.
Mm-hmm. So, yeah, there are the women who have been killed, and then there are those who decide to defend themselves. Lisa, would you talk about what are some of the strategies that you used? So when you started identifying, okay, this, I'm not changing this, there's no way, what was the first thing that you thought you could do?
Well, the first thing I did was I went to a divorce lawyer.
Oh, you were like, that's it, it's over.
Well, yeah. I mean, in terms of, once I had gotten to the point where I realized I couldn't fix it.
Mm-hmm.
And that's when, you know, I was faced with the fact that well, he said he would kill me and my children if I did that. Also, then again, you have the children unprotected in that situation. Mm-hmm. But he said, you know, I'll never let you leave. And I think it wasn't that even that he loved me, it was that I was property and he would be humiliated if I left. It wasn't about really caring about me.
Mm-hmm.
And so that was the first kind of strategy. And then I sought counseling for myself and for my children to try and mitigate some of the damage, because all of us were in trauma.
Mm-hmm.
I called domestic violence hotlines to get help. And I was told after this one particularly brutal attack that it was probably safer to stay with my husband and placate him. And this is true, because most women do get killed when they leave.
Mm-hmm.
And the psychopathology that he was exhibiting, they said that I was basically in danger of getting killed fairly quickly if I left, because of the things that he was doing and saying. I mean, the fact that he had said in front of my children that he would chop us into little pieces, or that he would burn our bodies so they'd never find it, he believed he could get away with it. And he was saying that, and they were saying, that's the worst. You know, you are in very, very serious danger. And if you leave, you will probably get killed.
Mm-hmm.
So that was one of the things that they advised. I tried to get my husband to go to rehab because, of course, the abuse was always worse when he was drunk or high, which he almost every day was. Mm-hmm. And so I thought, well, maybe rehab will fix this. But he wouldn't go, and me nagging about it just kind of made things worse. And again, I asked about going into witness protection and was told that that wasn't an option. I gave photos of my injuries to some of my friends because I thought, well, if he does eventually kill me, I don't want him to get away with it.
Hmm.
And then I copped a strategy of avoiding him as much as possible because I was walking on eggshells and playing the Stepford Wife so much, and it was just exhausting. And it was so stressful for my kids. They were exhibiting physical symptoms, you know, of all this. And so since he was a pilot, I would be at home while he was out flying. And then I would, like a day after he'd get home, say, well, I've got a job over here. And I'd take the kids and go. And I made it 6 months, only seeing him for maybe 20 days in that 6 month period, for 20 whole days, you know, mm-hmm. a couple half days here and there. And just being apart when he... it kind of minimized things until he figured out what I was doing. Mm. And then he got mad, you know. Then I called the police. And all that did was make things worse because they didn't arrest him, even though he had strangled me in front of my children to the blackout point. And at that point, I was packing up to just leave because I couldn't take it. And when the police didn't arrest him, he felt that he could get away with it. Mm-hmm. You know, it was like there was no accountability.
And I've heard you tell this story before. Would you actually describe the police arrives, you're outside with your car packed, and then what happens?
What had happened is he had strangled me, and then when I regained consciousness with my son actually brushing my face to try and wake me back up,
mm-hmm.
I ran for the phone and I dialed 911 and he ripped the phone out of the wall, but the police traced the call. So when they did arrive and I was outside with my two children and I was bleeding even, and he had strangled me, they talked to us and my children were crying and we were all very upset. Then they went inside and talked to him, and my husband had model airplanes of each of the different models he'd flown at, you know, DC-10 or Twin Otter or whatever, 737, sorry. But anyway, he had all these models, and 20 minutes later, they're basically plain model airplanes. You know, he was showing them off, and they were laughing and joking, and I'm horrified. I mean, he has just almost killed me in front of my children, and they're laughing with him. And I looked at them, and they had just completely forgotten about us out there. And they're like, oh, yeah, yeah. And then they kind of pat him on the back and say, oh, you guys just need counseling. You know, my wife and I needed counseling. And so that's how that went down. And I was just so horrified. And again, when they left, he said, bitch, you call the cops again on me, and I will kill the kids first and make you watch, and then I'll kill you. And so at that point, I knew I was not getting help from anyone. It was up to me to protect myself and my children because the police clearly weren't going to help me.
Mm-hmm. So I think that the very important point that you've been raising is how many times you try to leave and all of the dangers that come with leaving. I think sometimes people feel that, you know, it's an easy solution of just, you know, pack your stuff and go. But you've spoken about how, you know, taking your kids with you, and you mentioned, you know, leaving the country. But I'm sure if you leave the state, there's also potential kidnapping charges that can be pressed against you. And then there is, you know, oh, you're leaving, I'm going to actually try to kill you.
Right. Well, and one time I did run to my friend's ranch, mm-hmm. and he threatened to burn it down. And so then I felt guilty for jeopardizing other people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You're listening to Bread and Roses. We're going to take a short musical break. And then, you know, we're gathering here today. We have Lisa Swartz and Louis Bestard. And we are trying to understand how all these really great guarantees from the Violence Against Women Act have unfortunately not applied really in Lisa's case, and how we can make sure that they do for other women. So we're going to take a short musical break, and we are going to go to Eric Clapton. That's Nobody Knows You When You're Down. You're listening to Bread and Roses. I'm your host, Delphine Crescenzo, and I have with me tonight in the studio Lisa Swart and Louis Bestard. Both of them really strong advocates trying to defend women's rights, especially victims of domestic violence and, you know, women who unfortunately are either dying in the hands of their abusers or you know, taking a weapon and being incarcerated, which was the case of Lisa, who was incarcerated for 12 years for shooting her husband and killing him. Well, before the break, we were talking about, you know, some of the ways that, some of the things that you've tried. And what I'm wondering is, you know, in what ways you felt that the Oregon legal system just failed to implement the Violence Against Women Act in your case?
Well, very specifically, when the police didn't arrest Chris when he strangled me in front of my children, that mm-hmm. is a clear violation of the Violence Against Women Act. And it really reminded me of what's been in the news the last couple of days with the Portland Police Association president, Daryl Turner, mm-hmm. claiming that, you know, his buddy doesn't have an anger problem. He has a problem picking wives. Mm-hmm. And also that domestic abuse is a family matter. And he's not only dead wrong on that, he's violating the law mm-hmm. by saying that. And, you know, domestic violence isn't just a family matter. In fact, it costs the United States employers an estimated $3 billion, with a B, dollars a year in lost wages and compensation. So that was just a heinous violation of the Violence Against Women Act on the part of Daryl Turner.
And let me give some context for the people who are listening who maybe haven't read the Willamette Week. yet. If you haven't, please pick it up. But that's what they talk about. Pauline Kopp, under an internal affair investigation for allegedly tampering with Durr, also faces two formal misconduct complaints filed by two of his ex-wives. You know what the complaints, I'm quoting from the Willamette Week, along with other police reports that was obtained by Willamette Week, show that Lobo, that's his name, of the police officer Jason Lobo, 46 years old, has been investigated multiple times over the past 13 years for alleged threats and acts of physical violence against members of his own family. Lobo did not return multiple calls and emails for comments for the Willamette Week. But yeah, you were mentioning at the very end of the article, his wife, Gibson, that's his second wife, has told the Willamette Week about his horrible temper. And she had said, quote, "If I had done the things that he did, I would have been arrested and been in jail." This is the quote of the wife of this police officer. And as you say, Daryl Turner, who is the Portland Police Association president, talking about these domestic violence allegations against Lobro, say that they're part of his personal life, right? And his quote, which is priceless, quote, "He doesn't have an anger problem. He has a problem picking wives."
That's why Oregon has the second worst record on violence against women in the whole United States. It's because of men like that being in charge, and there's no accountability. I have a whole bunch of other violations that happened in the state of Oregon, where they did not enforce the Violence Against Women Act. On a separate incident, when I told the police that my husband had threatened to kill me, they didn't charge him, which was at yet another violations. When an emergency room physician pressed charges against my husband, and he did get arrested for the only time, the DA then in Bend did not notify me of the trial and dismissed the case against my husband when I didn't show up. When I went to the DA's office to find out when is this trial supposed to be happening, they have a record in the log of me asking about it. And it's a very explicit violation of the Violence Against Women Act, because they are required by law to notify victims, and they failed to do that. So that was pretty clear. They then destroyed the photos of my injuries that they had. And so, they were pretty significant injuries, 10-inch hematomas, and, just pretty brutal injuries, and they threw those away. I wasn't provided any counseling about my rights as a victim or how to file a claim. But I did write a victim statement that I wanted my husband to have to take batterer intervention classes. And I think that's pretty telling, because if that had happened, I'm fairly certain that he would be alive and our family would be much better off. I know my children would have been better off, and I would have been better off. Everybody would have. And again, they violated the law by not adhering to what they were supposed to. On another occasion, when I had a restraining order against my husband and the police called the house, he answered the telephone. So I was so relieved that he would finally be arrested, because they would be on their way since he answered the phone. And in fact, he was literally, not figuratively, but literally twisting my arm while I was talking to the police, once he handed the phone to me, so that I was saying all the right things. But when they asked me if I wanted to renege, I very clearly said no, because he didn't know what I was saying no to. And I thought, okay, they're getting this, They never came.
And if I can, just clarify. So again, the Violence Against Women Act is really trying to make sure that police officers out there who are in the field are educated about, domestic violence issues. And obviously, in your case, the officers who came to you, or in the case of this gentleman that we were speaking about, that the Willamette Week reported on, Lobo, there seems to be some discrepancy there. I mean, if they've taken the classes, I don't think that they've gotten it.
Right. It's not sinking in, and that's why we need a task force that is responsible for enforcing you know, the the adherence to this, and with the police officers, with judges, and with DAs. Because then again, when I did shoot my husband, I was arrested without a grand jury hearing. The sheriff's office destroyed documents after they were subpoenaed for them. The DA destroyed evidence. And then he told the governor and the press that although I had been beaten up and strangled, that that did not constitute significant domestic violence. And
who had said that?
The DA.
The DA.
Yeah. And which is, that is exactly why the Violence Against Women Act was written, because of this kind of ignorance and prejudice against women. I mean, he had the statements from my children that Chris had slammed my head against tables and doors, had thrown me out of moving cars, you know, had beaten me bloody. That's not significant domestic violence to some men. But this is in a rural area where also the police, I mean, the sheriff fired one of the guards at the jail where I was housed for showing up to work beaten up, which is also...
So she was a female guard.
She was a female guard, and her husband beat her up, and they fired her, which is also a violation of the Violence Against Women Act.
Yeah, so that they wouldn't see it. It's, you know, out of sight, out of mind.
Well, and it's the victim blaming.
Yeah.
You know, she must be such a bitch, you know, if her husband beat her up, you know, we don't want her around. It's kind of that mentality, the boy mentality. But it went even farther. Did they? They fired a male guard that said he was going to testify on her behalf. They fired him too. So they ended up settling out of court because she sued them.
Yeah,
but you know, unfortunately, it didn't go to trial because it would have been good to have the publicity. But what it is it got hushed up and nobody knows about it. You know, and that's the problem over and over and over again. So, and all of this happened on John Kitzhaber's watch. And this, you know, ultimately the buck stops with him. And as an ER physician, he should know, you know, 65% of female visits to the ER are domestic violence visits.
65%.
Yes, of female visits. 37% of all
visits.
But 60% of female visits. So it's incumbent upon him to change this. I mean, if he's happy and if he's proud of Oregon having this horrible record, you know, fine. But I can't imagine that as a doctor that he has, you know, any business letting this just slide. And I know that he appointed my husband, my current husband, who's very kind and nice, to the dentistry oversight board. And these people had, there were citizens, there were other physicians. If dentists didn't do things right, they got sanctioned and they got their license pulled and things happened. There was accountability for dentists. Why not for DAs and police officers and judges who are violating the Violence Against Women Act? I mean, I think, you know, it's incumbent upon John Kitzhaber and the legislator to have the same enforcement in the Violence Against Women Act that exists for dentistry.
And not only, you know, are they, should be held accountable to the Violence Against Women Act, but these are positions of power, which are, you know, to the highest level. I mean, they have authority over people's lives. And what comes next for them, whether they are being, you know, safe, you know, left safe in their home, or whether they are being prosecuted or not. I mean, these are like very powerful positions in our society. So,
absolutely, and in terms of state allocated funding, it's much cheaper to educate and enforce these laws than to, after the fact, then prosecute and incarcerate. You know, batterer intervention classes are cheap. You know, you can educate thousands of people for what it cost to incarcerate one.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a very good point. Yeah, and in cases where a woman dies and the husband ends up in prison, there's also where the children go. There is also, you were speaking earlier about, you know, lost income. This person is definitely not contributing to society. One is dead, the other one is incarcerated. So this is also a loss for our society. And also they, you know, they haven't learned how to be caring human beings.
Right. And not batterers. The thing, this is a huge myth. Batterers are not monsters.
Mm.
They really aren't. It's not that they're evil people. I think they're wounded people, and they react badly. And the reason that they react badly is they get away with it. It's easy to discharge this stress. They have a huge need to be in control for some reason, probably because they were hurt as a child. And if we can heal these people, everybody wins.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if we just, you know, treat them as monsters, they're not going to want to change. They will resist it. They will feel labeled and judged. Going to batter intervention classes, learning the skills, learning the tools, can help them and help their families, and then help the next generation.
Mm-hmm. And then also, if they are being threatened by, you know, the justice system to be, you know, held accountable to the highest level, that could also trigger some battering, right? So if you're being told you're going to lose your job and you're going to go to federal prison for battering your wife.
Right. And then, and also that's why a lot of women are afraid to call, because it's like, you know, their economic viability is often dependent for their children. It's like 50% of the homeless children and women are fleeing battering situations.
Yeah.
And so it's like, well, what's worse, to be on the streets or to put up with the getting hit a little bit? You know, what's better for my children? These are the things you actually think about.
Yeah.
And so, you know, it would just be so much better to have a climate of accountability where a batterer intervention program comes first. That way, for example, my husband was a pilot. A felony would have ended his career.
Mm-hmm.
Done. And he flat out told me, if you do anything that makes me lose my job, then I've got nothing left. You know, no reason not to kill you, for sure. So that's why, before it goes completely drastic, you can hold somebody accountable without it being drastic, where they know, okay, I'm being held accountable, but I'm not losing everything yet.
Mm-hmm.
So there's still hope to change. If you immediately pop them into prison right off the bat, there's no incentive to change. There's no, and then when you get out of prison, it's just so hard to get your traction again. So it's just like from 0 to 60. What I'm advocating for is definitely, you know, holding people accountable early on before it gets to crisis state.
You're listening to Bread and Roses. I'm Delphine Crescenzo, and we are having a conversation with Lisa Swart and Louise Bouchard about the Violence Against Women Act, about the great thing that it offers for our society and for women and battered women in general, but you know, some of the discrepancies, and making sure that that we are aware, so that we know, hopefully, how to better enforce this act. And we're going to take a short musical break, and then when we come back, we're going to talk about, you know, these strategies. Lisa's starting to lay some out, but there are a lot out there, so stay tuned, and we'll be back in a minute.
I remember days when we were younger,
We used to catch the opu in the mountain stream. Round the Kolau hills we ride on horseback. So long ago it seems it was a dream. Last night I dreamed I was returning, and my heart called out to you. But I feared you won't be like I left you. Me ke aloha kuho me o kahalu. I remember days when we were wiser, when our world was small enough for dreams. And you have lingered there, my sister, and I no longer can, it seems. Last night I dreamed I was returning, and my heart called out to you. But I feared I am not as I left you. Me ke aloha kuho me o kahalu.
You're listening to Bread and Roses. I'm Delphine Crescenzo, and I have with me in the studio Lisa Swartz and Louis Bashard, and we have been talking about the violence against women, and we've been talking about Lisa's story of domestic violence and how the violence against women act. And unfortunately, there were many ways that this was just did not implement for her case. Louise, you have founded Voices Set Free, and you do a lot of advocacy around it. And I know that one of the goals of your organization is to try to increase Oregon's enforcement of the Violence Against Women Act. So how do you think that you would do that?
Well, as I was mentioning a little bit before, enforcement for a program that is a mental health and peer-to-peer counseling program is probably not what we use as a way to move families forward. We have oftentimes understood that these denials need to be broken down in the family system so that there's a discussion that will come out of being in counseling or being in a peer-run group that allows people to have the insight and the capacity to recognize what's happening. At our Domestic Violence Intervention Council, there was a panel of men at one point that was convened to speak to the group of us who had all gone through batterer's intervention, and they were so willing to give back to us what happens when they actually had insight. They didn't understand why their kids ran away from them when they'd come home. They didn't understand what was going on in the family at all because they didn't have the skills. Mm-hmm. And after going through this experience, they realized that they were hurting their children, that they were minimizing their wives. It was an astounding thing to hear from these men. And in every case, they were able to continue with those relationships. But of course, it took, a year of getting through the stuff that's really painful. The first 3 to 6 months, they mm-hmm. don't even go there. But it was helpful to those of us who are working with the survivors to have some of the perpetrators speak. And in our classes, that's what we would do, is do that balance. We have to hear from everyone. And, of course, the children. Mm-hmm. We can't help but want to know what's going on for them, too, so that they're not forgotten and silenced by the experience, or they will walk around with huge difficulties all their lives.
Mm-hmm. So it seems that you know, education is and training mm-hmm. is one of the things that you do. Mm-hmm. And you know, I know that the Violence Against Women Act dedicates a lot of funds actually to education and training mm-hmm. State and local agencies about domestic violence, from the police to judges to social worker. So I'm wondering if, you know, for you, in your opinion, both of you, is education and training the way to go?
Well, education and training is the beginning way to start going, and as long as there's the dollars to really expand on it and deepen it. I mean, I'm still learning, and mm-hmm. I've been at it many years, and I'm recognizing the nuances of just one woman's story. Well, that won't necessarily apply to the next woman that we see, mm-hmm. and we don't want to make this cookie-cutter effort mm-hmm. to understand domestic violence. I mean, and families are put together in so many different ways, under so many different circumstances. What you as a child experience, you bring into the adult. We have our children then added to the family. And if we go for a minute thinking that, you know, education, what I found is so often it's lukewarm. It doesn't let people really experience it. I like people who can come into the field and actually work with those who are going through the experience, in a very kind way, work with them so that they can really understand the layers. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, we're just skimming. And that's what we're hearing with the police department. They're just skimming. And lip service is not what we need.
Mm-hmm. I think you made a really good point about the cookie cutter. Mm-hmm. Because what happens is everybody, not everybody, that's it. Mm-hmm. But many people have this picture in their mind that all battered women look like Francine Hughes. Mm-hmm. And that's not true. It's like saying all athletes are Shaquille O'Neal. Mm-hmm. Well, Christy Yamaguchi is an athlete too.
Yeah.
You know, there isn't just
that's
one
right.
way that a battered person mm-hmm. looks. And men are a percentage of that too, but a small percentage, much, mm-hmm. much smaller percentage. It's 5 or 10%. It's not 50%. Mm-hmm. You know, it's a small percentage. And education is very important for each component. The judges need to know what they are required mm-hmm. to do. Mm-hmm. The DAs need to know what they are required to do. The police.
Right.
But education doesn't matter if there's no enforcement.
Right.
So it's like a law does not exist if there's no teeth. Mm-hmm. If there's no enforcement of it, it might as well not be on the books.
Right.
So I think that they're like two wings on a bird. You have to have education and you have to have enforcement right. for it to soar. Otherwise, mm-hmm. it's just not going to work.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I also think that, you know, education, in my opinion, has to be more than just, you know, you take one class per, you know, mm-hmm. month or term. You know, you have to like renew, you know, make sure, let them know that, you know the terms, et cetera. How do you suggest we actually all become aware and more open and understanding of domestic violence, Lisa?
Well, for one thing, the mainstream media could do a much better job with educating people on this issue. It was really nice to see that this article was in Willamette Week, so that's a start. Mm. But, I mean, I think even having mandatory videos or DVDs, I'm dating myself with the word video, that all state employees, from everybody from the governor down to the custodians at the Capitol building to all teachers, nurses, school cafeteria workers, everybody that works for the state of Oregon needs to be educated on what is domestic violence.
The legislators, too.
Yeah, the mm-hmm. legislators. Everybody that's mm-hmm. employed by the state, because that's a pretty big section of the population. Mm-hmm. It's a good way to get a lot of people so that you know that choking is domestic violence. Mm-hmm. You know that threatening somebody to kill them, that mm-hmm. is actually domestic violence. Even if you don't hit them, that's still domestic yeah. violence. Mm-hmm. And so that everybody understands what it is. And then specific duty workshops, mm-hmm. almost like continuing legal education that lawyers have to take to keep their licenses. Like, I agree mm-hmm. with you, Del, that that's important to have an ongoing mm-hmm. education, but you have to start with the basic level and workshops and engagement. Mm-hmm. A lot of people have questions or assumptions that aren't, they don't really have a place to go to answer. So.
And when we had classes at Portland State and at Merrillhurst, the students are so eager to learn this information, and they say, why aren't we getting this in our degree? This should be a core curriculum piece, and it's not even offered as anything other than, you know, a weekend. And they're, you know, discovering that there's so little out there that really is available for them to learn, and then internships that allow them to be in the field. We're losing the opportunities that are right in front of us.
And as we are talking about these solutions, Louise, I was wondering if you can talk about the Duluth model, because I think what they are doing is very much what we're talking about here.
Well, there's so much that has come out of Duluth. They have done the power and control wheel for many years, showing how the different parts of the wheel, the spokes, come into play. And it's interesting when we use this, when we work with women in workshops and in school settings, we realize that it doesn't just come through the fist. You know, it isn't just with the name calling. It can come through the economic situation in a family. It can come through the faith based part of the family. It can come through how the discipline of the children is given. It can come through the emotional abuse. Emotional abuse is so misunderstood. It has such residual components that last for many, many months and years in your body. And until we get our education, we don't even understand what we're experiencing. You know, if you don't have terminology, which is what Duluth has done for us, it's given us terminology to assess ourselves and recognize, hey, this is me. This is what I'm going through. Humiliation, intimidation, looking at punishing our children, using the children as pawns in the relationship. And so that piece came on the scene at least 20 years, 25 years ago, and has been so helpful at identifying what its components are. And then they've come up with other kinds of wheels, the equality wheel, the nonviolence wheel, the faith-based wheel, and it goes on. And all of those need to be in the textbooks.
And so Duluth, which is a small community, I guess, in northern Minnesota. I had never heard of that town.
So
they've been, helping us understand, creating tools to help us all understand where we stand within this domestic violence, I don't know what a
continuum.
Good word. Continuum, or, you know, I was going to say something more negative than that.
Yeah.
But, because I think that if we know that domestic violence is happening and we don't act, then we are accomplices in letting it continue. But one of the things that that they are doing is very much in Duluth, some of the stuff that they are doing is very similar to what we were talking about. So really trying to hold the batterers accountable and keep the victims safe, right? So, they talk about how they take the blame off the victim, for example. Include offenders' accountability, keeping victims safe all across the agencies, whether it's criminal justice system. They also prioritize the voices of women who have experienced that, which I think, is very important. And that's one of the reasons why, I wanted Yulisa on the show tonight also, because it's very important that we hear from your story. So Duluth model is something really to look into. Go ahead, Lisa.
Well, I think something that's really important to point out about the Duluth model that a lot of people may not understand is they strongly not just advise, but not to go to couples counseling if you are in a domestic violence situation, because what that does is it tells the batterer that your victim is partly responsible, because there's two contango. And, and what it doesn't say is that battering is never okay, even if your partner does something wrong. That's not the way to handle it. That's what couples counseling doesn't do, because in most couples counseling, I know when I finally did get Chris to go, he said, if you mention anything that will make me lose my job, you know, I'm not going back. So I couldn't talk about the alcoholism or the battering. And so it was just really a bad situation. But so anyway, I just wanted to point that out. If somebody mm-hmm. right now is in a battering situation, do not go to couples counseling.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's not a solution.
It's okay. Dangerous, actually.
Right.
It's very dangerous.
Yeah. So as we wrap things up, I'm wondering if you can make some suggestion as to who is responsible then for making sure that the guarantees coming from the Violence Against Women Act are available for victims all over, the city of Portland, the state of Oregon, everywhere.
Well, when I talked to Hardy Myers, who was the Attorney General for the state of Oregon, about this, he didn't even know at that point. And he did apologize to me for the failure of the Oregon system in my case. And I mean, he said file a civil suit because, you know, the fear of having to pay a bunch of money might make them self-police. And that's kind of, I mean, it's sort of insulting to a battered woman. Mm-hmm. I mean, in my point, there have been, I can show actual damages. You know, I lost everything in my life, and my husband lost his life and my children. There was a woman who did sue the police department in another state when she called the police and her three children were found dead in her trunk of her car after they refused to come. So she could show actual damages. So that's not a solution. It's still something that should be done. I think we need lawyers that will handle these cases pro bono to kind of hold the police departments accountable. The FBI is, because it's a federal, the Violence Against Women Act is a federal law, they're technically responsible. So I called the FBI and filed a complaint, and they weren't even sure. And then they kind of looked it up and said, oh, I guess we are. So yeah, mm-hmm. go ahead and send us your stuff. So even they didn't know that they were really mm-hmm. responsible for mm-hmm. enforcing it, which is why I think that Governor Kitzhaber and the Oregon State Legislature needs to create a task force that is specifically responsible in this state, for mm-hmm. the state of Oregon, to enforce the tenets of mm-hmm. the Violence Against Women Act. Because mm-hmm. we, you know, a woman that calls the police and then they don't come doesn't know who to call. Mm-hmm. So if we have a task force and we publicize it, it's tacked up on all state
right,
you know, washroom
and
walls.
Then we have women who call the police, but it's an officer who has been abusing and attacking her, as we know with other women who go to prison.
Right.
And that is your last resort, and it isn't possible. So we have to be accountable to this woman for all her safety needs. We have to take, you know, into account that she often is a mother of young children. Why do we leave them alone in the woods? I mean, it's just as we have a report from the coalition about the number of homicides in this state. In the last year, it was 50. I mean, that's a high number of families just paying the ultimate price. And then, of course, there's the families who get split because of the judicial system sending one to prison. And our costs are enormous. I mean, if we just even looked at the cost financially of what this is doing to our state, and you mentioned one part of that, but that's one part, but it's exponentially
right. It's a
huge
effect. Well, and if there was somebody that that this police officer, Jason LeBeau, you know, if his wife had been able to call mm-hmm. somebody besides his buddies,
exactly.
you know, maybe he would have been held accountable yeah. right away
right.
and wouldn't be off doing more harm. Mm-hmm. And his supervisor or superior, you know, who mm-hmm. who has that attitude, if there was somebody to turn him into, mm-hmm. you know, we
right.
could maybe have a little bit more enlightened
and safe. Yeah. We'd have safety.
Right.
This woman would be safe.
And for those who just tuned in, we are making reference to the Willamette Week article and the comments by the president of the Portland Police Association, Daryl Turner, saying that this police officer, Jason LeBeau, he doesn't have an anger problem. He has a problem picking wives. That's quotes. Thank you so much, Lisa and Louise, mm-hmm. for being here. And to all of you, you know, if it comes on the ballot, task force to enforce the mm-hmm. Violence Against Women Act, make sure that you play your part in addressing these issues. You can learn more about Voices Set Free by going to voicessetfree.org. And also you can find out about Lisa's talents as a photographer by visiting piscespics.com. That's PISCESpics.com. Thank you so much for listening. Bretton Woods is a collective of women identify radio activists. We bring you feminist news and public affairs every Friday at 6. Make sure to go to our website, kboo.fm/Bretton Woods, and also on Facebook, KBOO Bretton Woods. And if you would like to join our collective, email Ani Haynes, volunteer@kboo.org. That's her email. Thank you, Chris, for engineering, and have a great week, everyone. And we'll leave you with Nina Simmons. That's Feeling Good.
Birds flying high, you know how I feel. Sun in the sky, you know how I feel. Breeze drifting on by, you know how I feel. It's a new dawn, it's a new day. It's a new life for me, yeah. It's a new dawn, it's a new day. It's a new life for me. Ooh, 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 ooh. And I'm feeling good.
We are listening to the end of Bread and Roses right now. We're going to Hard Knock Radio, so stay tuned. News, views, and hip-hop. It is 7 o'clock right now, and you are listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM.
You know how I feel. It's a new dawn, it's a new day, it's a new life for me.
I'm coming to our live on air.
Yes, a kookaburra bird is what I have an impersonation of.
Oh, this is wonderful. Kookaburra.
They're also from Australia.
That's right.
Okay, ready?
Yes, we are ready. Well, that was amazing. That was... we don't know what to say about that, except thank you.
Thank you.
Tune in to The Confessional with 2 solid hours of conscience-cleansing radio. Sundays at midnight, only on KBOO-FM Portland.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to help co-sponsor the Triangle production of American Fiesta, starring Gary Wayne Cash. A witty, hopeful tale of imperfection and acceptance. American Fiesta will take place at the Sanctuary at Sandy Plaza, 1785 Northeast Sandy Boulevard in Portland. This Triangle production will run from November 29th through December 22nd. More information about this KBOO-sponsored event may be found at kboo.fm on the right-hand side of the homepage under Community Events.
Hard Knock Radio. This afternoon, we have a very, very special guest in the building with us. Her name is Erica Blount Daniels.
Blount Danois, actually.
What? Okay, we're going to take it again. Blount Danois. Okay.
Blount, like count.
All right, 3, 2, 1. Okay. David D., it's Hard Knock Radio, and this afternoon, we have a very special guest. Her name